Chapter 10. "But I don't want anybody to kiss me, sir," she implored, a big tear beginning to roll down her face, and the corners of her mouth trembling in her attempts not to cry. "Andy, I wouldn't ha' come if I had known." He was inexorable, and she sat still, and D'Urberville gave her the kiss of mastery. No sooner had he done so than she flushed with shame, took out her handkerchief, and wiped the spot on her cheek that had been touched by his lips. His ardor was nettled at the sight, for the act on her part had been unconsciously done. "You are mighty sensitive for a cottage girl," said the young man. Tess made no reply to this remark, of which, indeed, she did not quite comprehend the drift, unheeding the snub as he had administered by her instinctive rub upon her cheek. As he had, in fact, undone the kiss, as far as such a thing was physically possible. With a dim sense that he was vexed, she looked steadily ahead as they trotted on near Melbury Down and Wingreen, till she saw, to her consternation, that there was yet another descent to be undergone. "You shall be made sorry for that," he resumed, his injured tone still remaining, as he flourished the whip anew. "Unless, that is, you agree willingly to let me do it again, and no handkerchief." She sighed. "Be very well, sir," she said. "H, let me get my hat." At the moment of speaking, her hat had blown off into the road, their present speed on the upland being by no means slow. D'Urberville pulled up, and said he would get it for her, but Tess was down on the other side. She turned back, and picked up the article. "You look prettier with it off, upon my soul, if that's possible," he said, contemplating her over the back of the vehicle. "Ah, then, up again. What's the matter?" The hat was in place and tied, but Tess had not stepped forward. "No, sir," she said, revealing the red and ivory of her mouth as her eyelid in defiant triumph. "Not again, if I know it. What, you won't get up beside me?" "No, I shall walk. 'Tis 5 or 6 miles yet to Trantridge." "I don't care if 'tis dozens. Besides, the cart is behind." "You artful hussy. Now, tell me, didn't you make that hat blow off on purpose?" "I'll swear you did." Her strategic silence confirmed his suspicion. Then D'Urberville cursed, and swore at her, and called her everything he could think of for the trick. Turning the horse suddenly, he tried to drive back upon her, and so hem her in between the gig and the hedge. But he could not do this short of injuring her. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself for using such wicked words," cried Tess with spirit, from the top of the hedge into which as he had scrambled. "Don't like ye at all. I hate and detest you. I'll go back to mother, I will." D'Urberville's bad temper cleared up at sight of hers, and he laughed heartily. "Well, I like you all the better," he said. "Let there be peace. I'll never do it any more against your will. My life upon it now." Still Tess could not be induced to remount. She did not, however, object to his keeping his gig alongside her. And in this manner, at a slow pace, they advanced towards the village of Trantridge. From time to time D'Urberville exhibited a sort of fierce distress at the sight of the tramping he had driven her to undertake by his misdemeanor. She might in truth have safely trusted him now, but he had forfeited her confidence for the time, and she kept on the ground progressing thoughtfully, as if wondering whether it would be wiser to return home. Her resolve, however, had been taken, and it seemed vacillating even to childishness to abandon it now, unless for graver reasons. How could she face her parents, get back her box, and disconcert the whole scheme for the rehabilitation of her family on such sentimental grounds? A few minutes later the chimneys of the slopes appeared in view, and in a snug nook to the right the poultry farm and cottage of Tess's destination. The community of fowls to which Tess had been appointed as supervisor, purveyor, nurse, surgeon, and friend, made its headquarters in an old thatched cottage standing in an enclosure that had once been a garden, but was now a trampled and sanded square. The house was overrun with ivy, its chimney being enlarged by the boughs of the parasite to the aspect of a ruined tower. The lower rooms were entirely given over to the birds, who walked about them with a proprietary air, as though the place had been built by themselves, and not by certain moldy copyholders who now lay east and west in the churchyard. The descendants of these bygone owners felt it almost as a slight to their family, when the house which had so much of their affection, had cost so much of their forefathers' money, and had been in their possession for several generations before the D'Urbervilles came and built here, was indifferently turned into a fowl house by Mrs. Stoke D'Urberville, as soon as the property fell into hand according to law. 'Twas good enough for Christians in grandfather's time, they said. The rooms wherein dozens of infants had wailed at their nursing now resounded with the tapping of nascent chicks. Distracted hens in coops occupied spots, where formerly stood chairs supporting sedate agriculturists. The chimney corner and once blazing hearth was now filled with inverted beehives, in which the hens laid their eggs, while out of doors the plots, that each succeeding householder had carefully shaped with his spade, were torn by the cocks in wildest fashion. The garden in which the cottage stood was surrounded by a wall, and could only be entered through a door. When Tess had occupied herself about an hour the next morning in altering and improving the arrangements, according to her skilled ideas as the daughter of a professed poulterer, the door in the wall opened, and a servant in white cap and apron entered. As he had come from the manor house. "Mrs. D'Urberville wants the fowls as usual," she said. But perceiving that Tess did not quite understand, she explained, "Missus is a old lady, and blind." "Blind," said Tess. Almost before her misgiving at the news could find time to shape itself, she took, under her companion's direction, two of the most beautiful of the Hamburgs in her arms, and followed the maid-servant, who had likewise taken two, to the adjacent mansion, which, though ornate and imposing, showed traces everywhere on this side, that some occupant of its chambers could bend to the love of dumb creatures' feathers floating within view of the front, and hen coops standing on the grass. In a sitting room on the ground floor, ensconced in an armchair with her back to the light, was the owner and mistress of the estate, a white-haired woman of not more than 60, or even less, wearing a large cap. As he had the mobile face frequent in those whose sight is decayed by stages, has been laboriously striven after, and reluctantly let go, rather than the stagnant mean apparent in persons long sightless or born blind. Tess walked up to this lady with her feathered charges, one sitting on each arm. "Ah, you are the young woman come to look after my birds?" said Mrs. D'Urberville, recognizing a new footstep. "Hope you will be kind to them. My bailiff tells me you are quite the proper person. Well, where are they? Ah, this is Strut. But he is hardly so lively today, is he? He is alarmed at being handled by a stranger, I suppose. And Fina too, yes, they are a little frightened, aren't you, dears? But they will soon get used to you." While the old lady had been speaking, Tess and the other maid, in obedience to her gestures, had placed the fowls severally in her lap, and as he had felt them over from head to tail, examining their beaks, their combs, the manes of the cocks, their wings, and their claws. Her touch enabled her to recognize them in a moment, and to discover if a single feather were crippled or draggled. She handled their crops, and knew what they had eaten, and if too little or too much, her face enacting a vivid pantomime of the criticisms passing in her mind. The birds that the two girls had brought in were duly returned to the yard, and the process was repeated till all the pet cocks and hens had been submitted to the old woman. Hamburgs, Bantams, Cochins, Brahmas, Dorkings, and such other sorts as were in fashion just then, her perception of each visitor being seldom at fault as she received the bird upon her knees. It reminded Tess of a confirmation, in which Mrs. D'Urberville was the bishop, the fowls the young people presented, and herself and the maid-servant the parson and curate of the parish bringing them up. At the end of the ceremony, Mrs. D'Urberville abruptly asked Tess, wrinkling and twitching her face into undulations, "Can you whistle?"
"Whistle, ma'am?"
"Yes, whistle tunes." Tess could whistle like most other country girls, though the accomplishment was one which she did not care to profess in genteel company. However, she blandly admitted that such was the fact. "Then you will have to practice it every day. I had a lad who did it very well, but he has left. I want you to whistle to my bullfinches. As I cannot see them, I like to hear them, and we teach them airs that way. Tell her where the cages are, Elizabeth. You must begin tomorrow, or they will go back in their piping. They have been neglected these several days."
"Mr. D'Urberville whistled to him this morning, ma'am," said Elizabeth.
"He? Who?" The old lady's face creased in two furrows of repugnance, and she made no further reply. Thus the reception of Tess by her fancied kinswoman terminated, and the birds were taken back to their quarters. The girl's surprise at Mrs. D'Urberville's manner was not great, for since seeing the size of the house he had expected no more. But she was far from being aware that the old lady had never heard a word of the so-called kinship. She gathered that no great affection flowed between the blind woman and her son. But in that too, she was mistaken. Mrs. D'Urberville was not the first mother compelled to love her offspring resentfully, and to be bitterly fond. In spite of the unpleasant initiation of the day before, Tess inclined to the freedom and novelty of her new position in the morning when the sun shone, now that she was once installed there, and she was curious to test her powers in the unexpected direction asked of her, so as to ascertain her chance of retaining her post. As soon as she was alone within the walled garden, she sat herself down on a coop, and seriously screwed up her mouth for the long-neglected practice. She found her former ability to have generated to the production of a hollow rush of wind through the lips, and no clear note at all. She remained fruitlessly blowing and blowing, wondering how she could have so grown out of the art which had come by nature, till she became aware of a movement among the ivy boughs which cloaked the garden wall no less than the cottage. Looking that way, she beheld a form springing from the coping to the plot. It was Alec D'Urberville, whom he had not set eyes on, since he had conducted her the day before to the door of the gardener's cottage, where he had lodgings. "Upon my honor," cried he, "there was never before such a beautiful thing in nature or art as you look. Cousin Cousin had a faint ring of mockery. "I have been watching you from over the wall, sitting like I am Patience on a monument, and pouting up that pretty red mouth to whistling shape, and wooing, and privately swearing, and never being able to produce a note. Why, you are quite cross, because you can't do it."
"I may be cross, but I didn't swear."
"Ah, I understand why you are trying those bullies. My mother wants you to carry on their musical education."
"How selfish of her.
As if attending to these cursed cocks and hens here were not enough work for any girl. I would flatly refuse, if I were you. But she wants me particularly to do it, and to be ready by tomorrow morning."
"Does she?
Well then, I'll give you a lesson or two." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.